Welcome to Explorations in Music, a production of KALW in cooperation with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This season, a triangle for the ages. Today, we discover just how difficult it was for Robert and Clara to ever get together.
Veek is carrying on like a madman and forbids Clara and me to have any contact under pain of death.
Dr. Robert Greenberg holds a PhD in music composition from the University of California at Berkeley, and since 1989 has been San Francisco Performance's music historian in residence. He has performed, taught, and lectured extensively in North America and Europe. The Alexander String Quartet is among the world's premier ensembles, maintaining a busy international touring and teaching schedule and recording for their own label, Foghorn Classics. Clara's father was jealously protective of her money-making potential, and he did everything in his power to keep her from seeing Robert Schumann. But Clara and Robert had other plans. Now here's Dr. Robert Greenberg.
We're going to sample the very opening of the third movement scherzo of Robert Schumann's piano quintet of 1842. Dang, that swings, doesn't it? Robert and Clara sitting in a tree. Yeah. Schumann's father died when Robert was 16 years old. According to the terms of his will, Robert was left a generous trust and a yearly stipend, provided that he go to a university and study law. That's not bad. That's what I call a good bribe. I would take that. Acceding to the demands and to the insistence of his mother, who insisted that Robert forget about a career in the arts, Schumann enrolled at the University of Leipzig in March of 1828, just a few days short of his 18th birthday. With a population of roughly 45,000 people, Leipzig was the second largest city in Saxony. Dresden, the royal residence, was the largest city. Known across Europe as Little Paris. You know, I think of that. You wonder, in Paris, do they call themselves Big Leipzig? I mean, Leipzigers, you know, it's very complimentary to call them. It's like, for a while, you know, I live in Oakland, and hundreds of restaurants are opening every year, and for a while, the locals were referring to themselves as the New Brooklyn. Do you think Brooklyn refers to itself as the Old Oakland? I don't think so. I just don't think so. Anyway, known across Europe as Little Paris, Leipzig was a great university town filled with teachers and writers and thinkers. Leipzig was, after all, one of the great European cities when it came to the performance, teaching, and publication of music. It was the city of Johann Sebastian Bach, where he spent the last 27 years of his life. It was the city of the Gewandhaus Orchestra, and soon to be the city of Felix Mendelssohn and the entire Bach revival. In fact, if Johanna Christiana Schumann really wanted to discourage her son Robert's interest in music, she could not possibly have chosen a worse place for his university education. So, did Robert Schumann honor the wishes of his mother and his dead father by attending classes in the law? No. Away from prying eyes, he did exactly what he pleased. According to Schumann's roommate, Emil Fleschsig, quote, "Once having arrived in Leipzig, Schumann never entered a lecture hall," unquote. what Schumann did was rent a piano and hire a piano teacher, a local dude named Friedrich Wieck. At the time Schumann met him, Wieck was 42 years old and promoting what he claimed to be his absolutely foolproof method of keyboard instruction. Wieck's proof of his method was his prodigy of a daughter, Clara. She was 9 years old in 1828 when she first met the 18-year-old Robert Schumann. Coming clean, yes. Schumann continued this law student charade for 2 entire years. He finally leveled with his mother on July 30th, 1830, when he wrote her a letter announcing his plans to become a professional musician. Ay vey, can you imagine the reaction? In the letter, Schumann claimed that in 6 years he would be able to hold his own against any living pianist. Not believing her son for even a second, Johanna Christiana Schumann wrote directly to Friedrich Wieck, who promised that he would, and I quote Wieck, make Robert within 3 years to one of the greatest living pianists who will play more warmly and ingeniously than Moscheles and more grandly than Hummel, unquote. And so at the comparatively advanced age of now 20, Robert Schumann began his all-or-nothing pursuit of pianistic greatness at the hands of Friedrich Wieck. Which leads us to the finger. Exactly which of Schumann's fingers on his right hand went on the Fritz is still being debated. Probably the ring finger, by the way, but we still don't know for sure. Whichever it was, as early as 1830, at the age of 20, Schumann was referring to a numb finger. His condition was almost certainly caused by repetitive stress brought on by the 8-hour-a-day practice regimen prescribed by Friedrich Wieck. Now, for our information, the psychiatrist and Schumann biographer Peter Ostwald, who many of us, I know Peter was a friend of mine, and many of you might have known Peter because he lived here in San Francisco. In his 1985 biography of Schumann, Peter claimed that the stiffness in the middle finger, he claimed it was the middle finger, of Schumann's right hand was a psychosomatic reaction to guilt over excessive masturbation. Having told you that, we go no further. Nor are we going to make bad jokes about Schumann's failed ambition as a pianist. Did he really say that? I apologize. We were talking about Gwendolyn grew up in Queens and I was born in Brooklyn and I just reverted while I was back there, so I can't be blamed. Whatever the cause, Schumann made things much worse by using something called a chiroplast, a sort of miniature weightlifting device for the fingers. He attached it to his finger and would exercise the finger endlessly. Well, by June 9, 1832, Schumann's injured finger was unusable. In November of 1832, the 22-and-a-half-year-old Schumann wrote, "For my part, I am completely resigned to my lame, useless finger, and I deem it now incurable." Friedrich Wieck was appalled by the injury. Oh, he wasn't worried about Robert Schumann, no. He was terrified that he would become known as a piano teacher who crippled his students through overwork. The upshot? Wieck put as much distance as possible between himself and his former student. There was no way that he was going to be blamed for laming Robert Schumann. But soon enough, even more appalling events would be going on right under Wieck's nose. Good people, some music. The brilliant and magisterial opening of Schumann's Piano Quintet of 1842. Clara at 16 was a rare young woman, brilliantly talented, beautiful, famous, intelligent, and sassy, at ease among adults, and increasingly aware of her power over men. Her 16th birthday was her coming of age, and she remembered that day as being one of the best days of her life. Robert Schumann remembered Clara's 16th birthday as well, because it was that day, as he said, that he allowed himself to fall in love with her. A few months later, he wrote in his diary, "Clara's birthday on September 13, Clara's eyes and her love, the first kiss in November, lovely hours in her arms in the evenings in the Wieck house, New Year's Day, 1836, the break with Wieck," unquote. Yes, the break with Wieck. Do any of us think that Friedrich Wieck was going to permit a romantic relationship between his 16-year-old Clara and the 25-year-old Robert Schumann, that nine-fingered loser? That's loser in 3D, for your information. Yes, naively, Robert had assumed that Wieck would welcome him as a prospective son-in-law. Ha, talk about taking a barge ride down denial. Of course, just the opposite was true. Wieck went berserk. Clara was not just his daughter. She was his life's work, his creation, his paycheck, his validation, his future. Clara Wieck was to be the greatest pianist of all time, not a Hausfrau. Period. End of conversation. Wieck threatened to shoot Schumann if he saw Clara again. He sent Schumann a brutal letter informing him that all connections between him and the Wieck household were severed. For almost a year and a half, Clara and Robert could not meet or communicate in any way. Friends kept Robert informed of Clara's whereabouts and her doings. On March 1st, 1836, Schumann wrote to his friend, August Collart, quote, "Wieck is carrying on like a madman and forbids Clara and me to have any contact under pain of death," unquote. For the next 4 years, Wieck employed every weapon at his disposal to get rid of Robert Schumann: slander, deceit, libel, and eventually even physical violence. Now, needless to say, Schumann suffered. He smoked too much, he drank too much, and he sought consolation from professional ladies, and in doing so, contracted the syphilis that would ultimately kill him. He earned his living as a music journalist, and he composed. His compositional inspiration? Clara, of course. In a letter to his old counterpoint teacher, Heinrich Dorn, Schumann confessed, quote, "My music can only be understood against the background of the battles Clara has cost me. She was practically the sole inspiration for the concerto without orchestra, the sonata, Opus 11, the Davidsbunde Tanza, the Kreisleriana, and the Novelettin," unquote. In August 1837, as Clara approached her 18th birthday, Schumann managed to have a letter spirited into her hands. It read in part, "Are you still firm and true? Just write me a simple yes if you are willing to hand a letter over to your father on your 18th birthday. Be strong. Our union will come to pass if we want it." Clara replied 2 days later, "So all you desire is a simple ja?" What a tiny word, but so important. Shouldn't a heart as full of love as mine be able to utter this tiny word? "I utter it, and my innermost being whispers it to you eternally. Would God make my 18th birthday into a day of grief?" Unquote. Yeah, maybe not God, but certainly Friedrich Wieck. Yes. Yes, not a problem. Schumann described what happened in a letter to Clara. "The interview with your father was dreadful. Nothing but frigidity, bad will, confusion, and contradictions." Over the next 2 years, Schumann's spirits rose to manic heights and fell to depressive depths with really alarming frequency, depending on the status of his relationship with Clara, until finally the last straw. I want you to know the basic Schumann biography runs about 600 pages. And this stuff with Wieck takes up probably 200 pages of it. So understand, I've demonstrated great restraint here in cutting to the chase as rapidly as I have. The last straw. On April 9th, 1839, Clara wrote Robert to inform him that Wieck was planning to disinherit her and keep the money she had earned from her concerts and at the same time initiate a lawsuit against both Clara and Robert if they did not cut off all communications at once. For Schumann, it was the last straw. Pushed to the very edge, he did what desperate people do. He hired a lawyer. Schumann's plan was to ask the Saxon court to grant him permission to marry Clara. For Clara, it was poop or get off the pot time. She was frantic with indecision. She wanted to marry Robert, but she still loved her father. In September of 1839, Schumann finally convinced her to sign the affidavit, and in doing so, initiate a lawsuit against her father. Clara later wrote, "The instant I signed was the most important in my whole life. I set my name down with firm resolution and was boundlessly happy." When he found out about the suit, Wieck went ballistic. He locked Clara out of the house, forcing her to move temporarily to Berlin, where she was reunited with her mother, Marianne. Wieck proceeded to make a complete fool of himself, if that was even still possible. He wrote to every piano dealer he knew and warned them not to let Clara play their pianos because she would destroy their action. He tried to drive away her audiences. He circulated false reports of her shameless, hussy behavior and described her as a miserable, demoralized girl. On those rare occasions when he encountered Schumann on the street, Wieck would spit in Schumann's face. Schumann wrote in his diary, "Unbelievably vile behavior on Wieck's part. I could hate him to the point of madness." In December of 1839, the parties finally met in court. During the proceedings, Wieck became so verbally abusive that he had to be silenced several times by the judge. The case and its appeals went on and on and on for 8 months until August 11th of 1840, when the court finally granted permission for Clara Wieck and Robert Schumann to marry without any compensation to Friedrich Wieck. Schumann wrote in his diary, "Happiest of days, the end of the struggle." Robert and Clara were married finally on September 12th, 1840, a date purposely chosen by the two to give Wieck the greatest possible pain where the sun don't shine. You see, the day of the wedding, September 12th, 1840, was the day before Clara's 21st birthday. On September 13th, the next day, she would have been legally free to marry anyone she wanted to marry. September 12th was the last possible day Friedrich Wieck could have been beaten, legally beaten. And Robert and Clara wanted to make sure that he knew he had been beaten. Piano Quintet in E-flat, major opus 44. Having finally married his beloved Clara, Schumann's already manic compositional drive went absolutely crazy. Check this out. In 1840 alone, he composed 135 songs, including the two Liederkreis cycles and the cycles Frauen Liebe und Leben and the Dichterliebe. In 1841, he turned to orchestral composing and produced, among other works, his Symphony No. 1, the Fantasia in A minor for piano and orchestra, which later became the first movement of his piano concerto, the overture Scherzo and Finale in E major, and he began his oratorio entitled Das Paradies und die Peri. Then 1842 rolled around, and Schumann got a bit freaky. In what is now called his Year of Chamber Music, he composed in a span of 9 months the three string quartets of Opus 41, the piano quintet in E-flat major, the piano quartet in E flat major, and the first of his piano trios, a work he entitled Fantasiestücke. The piano quintet was composed in under a month between the end of September and late October of 1842. Again, crazy. The speed of composition, notwithstanding, it is a masterwork of the first order, something that has been recognized since the moment of its premiere. For example, the review of its Berlin premiere in 1846 states that the quintet is, quote, one of the most important works of chamber music since Beethoven, unquote. And that it is, in my mind, the overwhelming first impression the piano quintet makes. Beyond its compelling themes, its brilliant use of the ensemble, and its complex counterpoint and formal coherence, is its incredible energy. The relentless rhythmic drive of this piece makes it rock. Movement one, sonata form. The first movement opens with, and we heard it, but we're going to hear it again, a brash and magnificent thematic statement, orchestral in scope, with a thematic melody that joyfully bounds and leaps upwards. Theme one. Theme two, set in B-flat major, is filled with restless yearning, a noticeably masculine yearning, given that the theme is presented low in the ensemble by the cello and the viola. Theme two. Movement two. Schumann indicates that this movement be played in the style of a march. For most of the movement, that would be a funeral march. Here's how movement two begins. Movement three is a double scherzo. I'll explain that in a moment. But this movement might rightly be called, "Look, Ma, what I could do with a bunch of rising and falling scales," because That's what he does. Rising and falling scales, a tremendous amount of mileage out of such a simple idea. Here's, again, the opening scherzo section, the A section of the movement, without its internal repeats. Now, as I said, the movement is structured as something called a double scherzo, meaning that there are two intervening contrasting sections or trios, creating a large scale form of A, the scherzo, first trio, B, a return to the scherzo, the second trio, C, and then finally the third and final playing of the scherzo theme, which is what we just sampled. The first trio, cast in the unusual key of G-flat major, sees a gentle canon, think row, row, row your boat, as one voice echoes another exactly. It sees a gentle canon between the first violin and viola, which floats above a bed of triplets provided by the piano. Trio one. The second trio, set in the key of A-flat minor, churns along regardless, like a six-year-old on a sugar rush. Movement four, sonata form. The last movement of the quartet is filled with everything, from stomping peasant dance music to Bach-like fugal counterpoint to a reprise of the first theme of the first movement during the movement-concluding triple fugue. For now, let's just hear the stomping peasant dance that begins this fourth movement. Clara, the dedicatee of the quintet, was entirely enchanted by it, and she wrote in her diary, "Magnificent! The quintet is a work filled with energy and freshness." And that it is. Conclusion. At the time he composed this piano quintet, Schumann, Clara, and their growing family were living in Leipzig, where Schumann was teaching at the newly founded Leipzig Conservatory. The founder of the conservatory was Schumann's good friend and fellow faculty member, Felix Mendelssohn. The premiere of the piano quintet, December 6, 1842, was to take place at the Leipzig home of Carl and Henriette Voigt. The quintet's dedicatee, Clara, was to play the piano part, but she became ill just a few hours before the performance and she couldn't play. So Felix Mendelssohn stepped in and sight-read this most difficult piano part. We are told, note perfectly, to have been a fly on that wall. Oh my goodness. Pianist Gwendolyn Mock joins the Alexander String Quartet in this performance of Robert Schumann's Piano Quintet in E-flat Major, Opus 44 of 1842. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Explorations in Music on KALW. Today's program featured Robert Schumann's Piano Quintet in E-flat Major, Opus 44. Tune in next time when we hear Robert Schumann's String Quartet in A Major. Explorations in Music is produced for KALW by Eric Wayne in association with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. For more information about San Francisco Performances and their upcoming events, visit them on the web at sfperformances.org. The Alexander String Quartet are violinists Zacharias Grafilo and Frederick Lifsitz, violist Paul Yarbrough, and cellist Sandy Wilson. You can find out more and purchase recordings of the ASQ on their website, asq4.com. The lecturer was Dr. Robert Greenberg, music historian in residence at San Francisco Performances. The concerts were recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. You can join us on Facebook by searching for Explorations in Music. Our email address is explorations@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. I'm David LaTulipe.